Take a moment to listen to all the sounds around you right now. Maybe it's the low hum of fluorescent lights, a blowing heater, distant traffic, the tap of a coworker's typing, and, of course, my voice on the radio. Hearing is one of the senses that we're not always completely aware of, so for this week's Please Explain, we thought we would look, or rather listen, closely to how we hear and how the sounds around us affect our brain and behavior. Joining us now is Seth Horowitz, an auditory neuroscientist at Brown University and author of The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. It's published by Bloomsbury. Seth, thank you for being on our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
And we also invite our listeners to join in the conversation. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, or also on Facebook and Twitter. So, Seth, what is sound? Is it simply a vibration?
Well, it's actually sound out there is vibration in some medium. It's basically energy acting on matter, and we've evolved to pick this up. It's a really ancient sense. We started picking it up when there were vibrations underwater, and when our ancestors moved on to land, we suddenly had to start hearing in air. And it's one of those types of energy that surrounds us. So it's become our three-dimensional sense, one that goes on out of line of sight in total darkness, even when we're sleeping. It's become our alarm clock, our kind of universal guarding and environmental notifier.
Does the shape of the ear, the outer ear, affect our hearing, those folds?
Quite a bit. If you look at animals that are very devoted to hearing, like bats and desert foxes and rabbits, the ones that are very sensitive to sound, they often have these incredibly ornate ears. I mean, some of the ears of bats have these incredible ridges and folds, but if you just look at a person's ear, almost everybody's ears are different. The little folds that you get in it do fine shaping of the sound, especially higher frequency sounds. The ear itself acts to gather lower frequency sounds, so it's sort of like using those old-fashioned ear trumpets, but the shape of the ear imposes changes on the sounds, so that if you used a microphone called an in-ear binaural, where you actually put the microphone into your ear canal facing outward, and you record with that, and then you listen to it, what you're hearing is a very human experience. It's not like listening to a microphone on a shotgun microphone on a stick. You hear what it sounds like to somebody else's ears.
Well, unlike many animals, the ones you mentioned, dogs and cats as well, our ears are in a fixed position. So how do we know where sounds are coming from? I mean, when we watch our pet rotate their ears to listen to a sound, it's quite clear what they're doing.
That's something I've always been jealous of. I have a cat, and I just sometimes wish I had like those little radar dome ears. But even with our fixed ears, we have neural adaptations that let us localize where sound is in space with a great degree of accuracy. But you have to break it up. Very low-frequency sounds have longer wavelengths. And let's say you have a sound off towards your right, the sound will come, and longer wavelengths will wrap around your head, but the sound will arrive at different times from your right ear and your left ear. And you have parts of your brain called the superior olive, and parts of it will compare the time of arrival between your two ears, and you're talking extremely short periods of time, thousandths of a second. And yet it'll be able to do a calculation that says that sound arrived slightly before this one, it's closer to this ear. But that only works for low-frequency sounds. High-frequency sounds, something above 5 kilohertz, above the musical range, the wavelength is too short, so it won't wrap around your head. It'll bounce off side of your head. So your head makes a sound shadow. So for high-pitched sounds, like squealing brakes or something like that, you tell where it is because it's a difference in intensity between the left and right side of your head, so that you figure out where the high frequencies are with sound shadowing and the low frequencies are with time of arrival between your two ears. Your outer ear just adds fine structure to the sound, which also mostly helps figure out where things are vertically.
Well, dogs can hear higher frequency whistles than humans can. Mm-hmm. So at a certain point, do we just blank it out, or are we just incapable of hearing a really high-pitched sound?
We have every species has its own limitations on its own frequency range. Humans have quite a good one. You know, the idea that dogs have better hearing than you is not really true. We have about the same sensitivity. Dogs just have a higher upper range, and there's some question about how good their lower range is. Also, the size of the animal makes a huge difference. There have been studies that show that Chihuahuas will have a different frequency range than a Great Dane, just as we have a very different frequency range than either a mouse or an elephant. Very large animals tend to be very sensitive to low-frequency sounds. This is why elephants can actually use infrasound, sounds way below what we can hear, and use it to communicate across very, very long distances, or even rumble, send the sound into the ground and figure out where water is. On the other hand, you've got something like a bat or a mouse, who are tiny little animals and really don't hear anything in our range very well at all. But because it's high frequency, they're very good at picking up other environmental features. Mice have ultrasonic signaling that many larger predators can't hear, so they can communicate. Especially baby mice give out these little shrill alarm calls to their moms that almost nothing else can hear. It's a little private communication channel. And bats are the masters of high frequency because they're so devoted to high frequency sound that they build a world out of 3D sound using all frequencies beyond our range.
So does that apply to us as well? Is our range largely the bottom and the top of our vocal range plus a little bit more?
No, human vocal range tops out, I think, around 5 kilohertz, and that would be really squeaking it. A male, a fundamental frequency, the base frequency of most adult males, is between 150 and 200 hertz. It's like more or less the pitch of my voice. Mine's slightly higher pitch, so I'm up around 200 hertz. Adult human females, it's usually higher, 250 to 300 hertz. Very small children can squeal up at around 1,000 hertz, which is, you know, that piercing cry that they make. But we hear way beyond our vocal range. This is why a lot of the old ideas about hearing from the 60s and earlier, and we've been studying hearing for centuries, don't hold up. The idea was an animal hears best only from its own species, the idea that we're sort of mating call detectors. You want to hear your own species. The problem with that is you'll be eaten by the first predator that makes a sound outside of your vocal range. So we hear far beyond our own vocalizations. We have to listen to things in the environment. And a lot of them make sounds way past what we normally would vocalize as.
My guest on today's Please Explain is Seth S. Horowitz, a neuroscientist and an assistant research professor at Brown University. He's written a book called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. It is published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How is it that we seem to hear faster than we see, even though sound moves slower than light?
Well, that's because the speed of light is not biologically relevant. I mean, if you pick up a book or a Kindle or something, the time that it goes from the surface you're looking at to your eyes is so fast, it can bounce back and forth billions of times before you could actually register that something was moving. But vision is actually a slow system. You have to take input to the eyes. Your photoreceptors are not mechanical. They have a very complex, what's called a second messenger system. It's relatively slow. You have processing within the retina, sends a signal all over the human brain. And when it gets to the cortex, the visual cortex in the back of our head, you put together all the pieces. When you're looking at something, you're not seeing a dog. You're seeing the lines and the curves that make up its outline. You're seeing the colors separately. You're seeing shading and movement all in different parts, and your brain has to put that together. So if you look at a map of visual connections in the human brain, it's like the worst subway nightmare you could ever imagine. Hearing is different. Hearing is a mechanical sense. And while the speed of sound is pretty slow, 1,000 feet per second, so it's about 5 seconds to go a mile, because it's mechanical, it operates on a much faster scale. Visually, it can take you a quarter to three-quarters of a second to see something and recognize it. You start recognizing sounds within 51,000ths of a second. And to demonstrate to you, let's say you're going down a dark alleyway, and you can't see anything very much, but suddenly there's a sound behind you. It only takes five neurons to go from your ear to the muscles in your body to get you to jump, to start looking around to see what made the sound. If you had to look around and identify what suddenly startled you, it would be a second or two. That's why sound is so fast, it acts under our conscious behavior for a lot of the time, and it's our early warning system.
A listener asks on Twitter, do sound waves ever end? If not, can a device capture sound that was made 1,000 years ago? I mean, we have heard the echo of the Big Bang, haven't we?
Well, okay, first, that's a great question. Sound does finally fade out. What happens is that sound is spreading in a sphere, and you're vibrating the air molecules, but every time it vibrates, it loses a little energy. And since there's no such thing as total silence, as long as you've got a medium, you've got an atmosphere, what will happen is eventually sound, the vibrations will lose enough energy that they basically disappear into the heat noise, the thermal noise that's always going on in the atmosphere. But you can get quite a range out of sound. On a nice still day with a flat level surface, you can hear everything in about a hemisphere about a kilometer across, a half a mile or so. In terms of hearing ancient sounds, there have been people who have tried to pick up how sound has changed things like wet pottery. It hasn't worked too well, but it's a very nice theory. But sound will eventually die out with distance.
Well, let's take a call from Jeff from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff.
Jeff?
Yes, I wanted to find out when do we as humans discriminate between background noises and noises that are relevant to us?
This is the question that I was going to be moving toward, interpreting sound. There's a lot of noise out there, and yet, for example, if your baby cries in the midst of a lot of noise, you still can discriminate, can hear right away that it's your baby.
Yes, and this is throughout the animal kingdom. It's sort of the difference, it ties in the difference between hearing and listening. You're hearing all the time. Even when you're asleep, your auditory system works. That's why, you know, it's a very adaptive thing that, you know, if you're asleep in a total darkness and you suddenly something's sneaking up on you and you hear it crack the branch, you'll wake up. If something is something that you have been exposed to before, it's your baby's cry or even just a baby cry, what it will do is it'll go past the threshold that you set that for background noise. You're in New York City. I was born in New York City, spent most of my life there in my mid-30s, moved to Rhode Island. I went from Brooklyn, where it's about 70 decibels. 70 decibels is a loud conversation. You know what it's like on the street, especially when you're in an elevated train. I moved up here, and the average background sound is about 45 decibels. That would be considered a frighteningly quiet place in New York, but here it's normal. And I couldn't sleep for weeks because I had to shift the normal background sound in my head. You do the basic shift in a matter of minutes, but getting used to it over the long term to say that this is normal can take you quite a while because you really rewire your brain to be able to pick it out. But if you have something goes over your threshold, you suddenly hear a weird noise. A couple of nights ago, it was quiet here, and all of a sudden I hear a crash. And it's like, I wake up immediately. My wife's one of those people who sleeps through anything. So I had to go downstairs and found that some animal had knocked over the trash can. It wasn't that loud, but it went over my threshold, and it was an unknown sound. So I got up, I paid attention to it, and I went to go check it out. Attention is run by different parts of the brain, but it's often triggered by a stimulus like a novel sound or a very loud sound. So the difference between the two is familiarity, which will make you shift your attention to it, or novelty, something that goes over the threshold you can't recognize, and then you'll pay attention to it.
And doesn't that work the other way as well, about hearing when we sleep? A friend lived near a train, and when the trains were on strike, he'd wake up every 10 or 15 minutes because the trains weren't going by on schedule.
I had something similar as well. I don't live near the subway anymore, but I don't live too far from the Amtrak, and there's a 2 a.m. freight train. Always goes by, and for some reason a couple of weeks ago, it didn't go by for a couple of nights, and I didn't know why it was waking up. And then I noticed that it's missing. And it wasn't a fun sound. You know, it shakes my whole house. But it was part of my normal background, and suddenly it was missing. Silence itself is, we all say we want quiet, but true silence is disturbing. If something is missing, that can get us worried about what's going on, can increase our arousal and make us pay attention.
But it also makes us aware of our own heartbeat, our pulse. If there's real silence, you wind up hearing your pulse in your ear, don't you?
Yeah, true silence frightens most people. If you can ever have a chance to go to an anechoic room, universities sometimes have them, really good sound studios have them, where the walls are covered with this textured foam, and you go in and it's nice and quiet in here. And then you start hearing this hissing sound. And the hissing sound is actually the air molecules resonating within your ear canal. And it's a very odd experience. And then after a while, you start hearing your own heartbeat. And that's when most people want to leave.
My guest is Seth S. Horowitz. He is a neuroscientist, assistant research professor at Brown University, and the author of The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. It's published by Bloomsbury, and it's giving us our topic today on Please Explain. We'll get into how the role that hearing plays in memory, in the development of children, and of course we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. All coming up after we take a little break. We are back with neuroscientist Seth S. Horowitz. His book, The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind, it's published by Bloomsbury, and hearing and sound are the subject of today's Please Explain. How well do newborns hear?
Newborns hear pretty well, but they do go through significant development. They start off with really small ears, so they're better at picking up high frequency, and they actually start hearing in the third trimester. At about the beginning of the third trimester, the ears connect to the brain, and a third trimester fetus does in fact pick up sounds from the external environment. It's sort of like I spent many years doing frog research and learned that tadpoles hear, and tadpoles turn out to be a great model because they hear in shallow ponds too. So there have been several recent studies that have shown that a child will pick up some of the preferred speech sound of the mother's primary language.
And you say in the higher frequency, is that why people tend to talk to their children in that high baby voice?
It gets their attention better. They're not very good at low-frequency sounds. And also, low-frequency sounds tend to imply size, and they tend to be scary for almost all age groups. If you hear a very deep voice, it means something very big. And, you know, this can work in a positive way, the Barry White effect. But if you suddenly hear a low-frequency sound that is not coming from someone you know, it means something big is nearby you and you want to check it out.
Well, do younger people hear higher frequencies better and older people tend to hear the lower frequencies better?
Well, what happens is that even at birth, and very young children, we have a very broad frequency span, and little kids hear the highest frequencies, up to about 20,000 hertz, which is right at the edge of bad echolocation. And as you get older, starting at about 30, you regularly lose the high-frequency hearing. This is called presbycusis. It's so common that it's considered a regular marker of aging. The problem is it can be accelerated by noise exposure, by playing your music too loud, by living in a noisy environment, and it's insidious. You lose the high-frequency hearing, and a lot of people just sort of notice people seem to be mumbling or it's harder to hear in background. And if they look at the curves of what they're hearing, they're still hearing fine inside the speech range. But what you lose, a lot of the tiny little details that give you cues about where a sound is coming from, environmental sounds, tiny little bits that identify one person's voice as opposed to another. So as we lose this high-frequency hearing, we're losing a lot of the richness of our auditory world, and this progresses across your life. To the point that by 60 or 70, approximately 75% of people have lost a good chunk of their high-frequency hearing.
Do all people have similar responses to alarms and sirens, on the one hand, sharp noises, on the other hand, what we might consider soothing sounds?
There are basic things that get right into your brainstem and can be frightening or at least attention-grabbing. Very loud, sudden sound will make you startle. Low-frequency sounds gives everybody a built-in measure that there's something large nearby. Something that's high and piercing doesn't give you the idea of a large animal nearby, but because we all have exposure over thousands of years with insects, which usually put out sounds above the speech range, 6,000 hertz and higher, a small whiny sound can be very irritating as well. On the other hand, there are sounds that are universally calming and soothing. And it's not so much the individual sound, but its characteristics of it. One example I used in my book was talking about a cat purring. This is a sound that's, unless you know, most people find it very soothing. It's a breathing sound. If you have been around cats, it represents a happy animal, one who's just sort of lying around and likes to be petted. And you bring your own personal history to it. But then again, I had a student who would shudder when she heard the cat purr sound because she personally hated cats. And so it's not a universal. Everyone brings their own history to it. This is one reason that some people love some forms of music and just absolutely cannot stand others.
Also, Western music has certain kinds of chords that we favor, but when you listen to Japanese or Chinese music, it can be quite different.
One of the examples that I always found fascinating was a student did a project at Brown where she was a big devotee of gamelan music, which is from the Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And gamelan doesn't use the 12 semitones or the 8 major steps that most Western music uses. It uses 256 steps per octave, and even within the same instrument, they'll have fine detuning. So it's a very rich sound, but it can be very grating on the ear. And she actually did this neat little study as an undergraduate where she had people who were students who had never heard gamelan music, and she played Western music for them, and she played gamelan music and said, which do you like better? Which intervals do you like? And, you know, they liked the Western intonation and the music, and the gamelan, they all said sort of, this is irritating. Then she ran the same thing. She played gamelan in the background before running the study for quite a while so that they were exposed to it. And all of a sudden, the numbers changed. Just with an hour or so of exposure to the music, a significant proportion of people decided that, oh, they kind of like this. And this is something that is amazing about hearing and the brain in general. It's our plasticity.
Let's put Hank on the line from Fort Lee. Hi, Hank.
Hi, Hank. Leonard, how are you?
I'm okay. Quickly.
Yes, there's an illegal dog downstairs in my co-op, and I'm going to mediation in 2 weeks about it. But it's really hard to get used to intermittent yappy barking, and I think it points to that study of irritating sounds. But I wonder, is there any sort of research into intermittent sounds in a quiet place and what it does to one's enjoyment of quiet?
Can it cause anxiety? Can we actually? I know that one of the weapons that's been used sometimes is to play loud music to people who are holed up in a house. Can you condition people to be anxious?
Oh, yeah, especially what he's describing is intermittency. Our brains really like patterns. They like consistency. You can get used to hearing music through a ceiling or a wall after a while, unless you really hate the music or it's very loud. But anything that's intermittent and is in a frequency range that just kind of startles you constantly can be very antagonizing, because you can't get your brain to the point that I'm used to this. You can't shove it back into your background. It's something that will keep grabbing your attention, and attention is tiring. I mean, we all pay attention when we have to, but if something keeps grabbing your attention when you're trying to relax, it's very arousing. It can, and chronic exposure to loud noise, to irritating noise, has a lot of health effects, ranging from just overall stress, sleep interruption. There's a lot of good studies showing effects on cardiovascular health in loud and chronic noise situations.
Is it possible to create a weapon with sound? Can a very high note really shatter a glass?
Oh, yeah. Weapon, yes, it can, but a glass is not, it can't make your head explode, unfortunately, as cool as that might be in some circles. There are acoustic weapons. The LRAD is extraordinarily powerful for driving people away. It's a very loud sound that you can't escape as long as you're nearby it, and it activates your fight-or-flight system, and your response is run away. And if you're exposed to it long enough, it will damage your hearing. This is why it's an effective crowd control device, because you can just point it at people, and they will move away from it. It is not safe to approach it. It's not an invincible weapon, because just wear really good sound protection or have someone who's deaf, and they're just not going to have any problem approaching it. Regarding other acoustic weapons, it's a cool idea, but there really is not that anything that effective out there. Ultrasonics get used in science fiction a lot, but ultrasonics just bounce off your head and you can't hear them.
But should I assume that that person who's wearing headphones and next to me on the subway, but I can hear everything, is damaging his ears?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if they have open cell hearing headphones, that can leak more noise, but if you can hear it outside through the headphone, their sound is too loud. And that's why I've been very happy to see that a lot of, especially the ones that are marketed to children, have automatic volume limiting. Unfortunately, the ones that aren't for kids, you can override it. And people don't understand how easy it is to cause long-term damage to the hearing that will drastically affect them later in life, because right now you really want to put the music on loud so you can go for a run.
A number of listeners have asked about the songs and the jingles get stuck in your head. Is that a hearing issue?
It's a hearing issue, but it's a brain plasticity issue. The term is usually called an earworm, something that gets stuck in your ear and you can't get rid of it. There's a lot of factors that go into it, and advertisers have been looking for the ideal earworm for many, many years. I mean, I can still remember most of the commercials from when I was a little kid, ranging from Oscar Mayer to the cigarette ads that you don't hear anymore. But what an earworm does is it's something that's familiar. You've usually heard it multiple times. And if you've heard something multiple times, whether it's through an ad or you just like the piece of music or you've been exposed to it because someone else kept playing it, your brain actually rewires itself to make the next time you hear it simpler. You're creating this little model system in your head of that stimulus. And this is why if you have a sound, song you've heard, you can think about it and actually hear it inside of your head.
Seth, we have very little time, and I did want to touch one other thing, the cocktail party effect.
Ah, okay.
Can you do it in a half a minute?
I can do it in a half a minute. Cocktail party effect, it just demonstrates how good you are at picking something interesting out to you. If you're in a really noisy environment, a cocktail party, a crowded room, you're not going to be able to pick out voices and such, but if someone says your name, barely audible, no machine could pick it up, you'll hear it. Because that's something that you have set up significant neural traces. You've heard your name. It's important to you. You will pick it out of the noise. And that's something almost no other sense can do.
We also get annoyed when we hear somebody talking on a cell phone, but it doesn't bother us when we hear two people having a conversation.
Right, because a cell phone, if you hear a conversation, you're getting information from both sides. When you're hearing a cell phone conversation, you're only getting one side, and the term for that was a haversation. And so what's happening is that you're getting information, you're getting verbal information, but you're not getting what triggered it. And you sort of
Seth, I got to leave it there. I'm sorry. Seth S. Horowitz, his book, The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind, from Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being on Please Explain today.